have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey, y'all. This is a spooky Susie. No, a spooky season reboot of Art and Murder and Wine Part 2, originally released on October 30th, 2018. Heads up, listener discretion is advised. We do talk about some violent and potentially disturbing, definitely disturbing topics. So this episode is not appropriate for children and may be upsetting for some. So do keep that in mind at your own discretion. Otherwise, enjoy the episode.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Jen.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Ginny.
And we are the Art History Babes.
Part two.
Part two.
Art and Murder. We're even deeper into a well of wine. And
oh, man.
And we're talking about some just crazy stories of where art and murder have collided throughout history.
Because
really.
It's happened.
Yes.
We each chose a story to cover, and so that's what we're doing. If you haven't listened yet, you should check out part one. Some good stuff happened.
Yeah.
I mean, some terrible stuff, actually.
Yeah. Terrible stuff, but good
some
for
loss
us.
Of life.
Yeah. Some really, like, ugly stuff, but, like, very dramatic.
But also art.
Yeah. Interesting content.
And it happened. We didn't make it up. It's what happened.
It's just what happened.
Yeah. We're just telling truth.
We don't support it. Yeah. So this is part two of our 2018 Halloween kind of... I like your ghost sound.
I know. It's been coming out a lot lately.
It is. Ooh, boo, boo.
Part two of our 2018 Halloween extravaganza. We're actually hanging out all weekend. We're going to hit a pumpkin patch.
I am so excited.
We're going to hit a haunted trail tour.
I am so excited.
You guys, if I see a ghost tomorrow, I'll literally have achieved a goal that I've had since I was 6 years old.
I want to see
everyone's
a ghost.
Really banking on a ghost.
It's going to be great. We're
going to see something spooky.
Oh, it's going to be spooky.
If we get high, we definitely will, because I always see shit in the woods.
We're also going to make some, like, YouTube videos and stuff of us doing Halloween activities, so you should probably check out our YouTube. But this is part two of our Halloween special, Art and Murder. We got a couple more stories for you. Let's just go for it. Jen, what do you got?
Oh, okay. Well, I thought that it would be really appropriate to talk about art that is actually made by murderers. And
murderers.
So there's many examples of this. There are some high-profile serial killers that have become somewhat like legends in our American cultural lexicon. So people know of, like, Jeffrey Dahmer, Charles Manson, Ed Gein, like all of these killers who, Ted Bundy, like these people who have made a name for themselves by being horrific killers who murdered and murdered in a systematic way and murdered
in an intentional
and
way.
An intentional, systematic, and in many cases almost like creative, almost something about these killings of these high profile serial killers, like we talk about them for many, many years after because it's so scandalizing.
Oh yeah.
So as a culture, I think that we are, even though we know it's horrific and just bad, like we're still like, oh, well, when yeah. we hear about this.
It's like, it, yeah, it's not like trying to elevate it. It's just like so jarring. I feel like you have to talk about it.
Oh, because yeah.
like we all experienced very recently, like the Golden State Killer
yes.
drama that ensued. And that was just, weird because right. it was so close to home. Like oof. Just speaking personally, like he lived in
Citrus Heights,
which is like the right. city adjacent to where I lived, and
we're in
his
Sacramento
ex-wife,
currently.
Yeah, his ex-wife lived in my neighborhood, the neighborhood I grew up mm-hmm. in. She literally lived three houses, still lives three houses down from my boyfriend's mom's home. So oof. Like, yeah, the house that he
what
grew
a
up
life
in.
It's, she leads.
Oh
now.
My gosh! Oh, how my horrific! Oh, the news were like hounding her
so
right after.
Sure.
Oh God. Poor,
you know, so
that's not hard enough.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, we're naturally as humans attracted to the macabre.
Oh, definitely. And I've been since I was little, since I was like an age far too young to even fully grasp what was happening. I've really enjoyed things like learning about serial killers or learning about cults or learning yeah. about these like darker things, because I think there's just something intriguing about it. Doesn't mean you encourage it or approve no. of it in any way. There's just something, it's just a complicated, fascinating part of human life.
It's like a fear fueled fascination.
Yeah, definitely.
Check out that alliteration. Hot damn.
Fear fueled fascination.
And on that note,
hashtag that gem. Shit.
That's a
really, great hashtag.
Yeah, it's a great hashtag, and it's a great way to describe what it is that goes on in our minds when we hear stories about murderers. For us in the 21st century, taking another human life is a humongous taboo. Maybe this wasn't necessarily as big of a deal when we were like hunter-gatherers, when we had to literally fight for our lives and resources with one another, but it's definitely become more taboo when there are these people that have made a name for themselves because they not only murdered one or two people, they murdered a lot of people.
Yeah.
Maybe they organized a cult and brainwashed a bunch of people to make them carry out murders. Like, these things are fascinating to us because it shows us the most horrific side of human nature.
Yeah, definitely.
And so we're all fascinated and horrified by how dark and evil we can all be. We all yeah. have the ability to lose it one day and murder somebody.
Like, you're not doing yourself somebody. A service to act like you are different
you're
than
not.
People who do this. Like, it's
so, yeah, and that's why murder freaks us out, is because we all have that potential mm-hmm. to do the same thing. So on that note, I thought that it would be interesting to talk about some artwork made by serial killers. And one of the weirdly most prolific serial killer artists that we still talk about today is John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy was an American serial killer and rapist. So he's famous because he sexually assaulted, tortured, and murdered at least 33 teenage boys and young men between 1972 and 1978 in Cook County, Illinois. All of Gacy's known murders were committed inside of his Norwood Park Ranch house. Gacy was born in Chicago, Illinois in 1942. He was the second of three children and the only son born to John Stanley Gacy, who was an auto repair machinist and World War I veteran, and his wife, Marion Robinson, who was a homemaker. So as a child, Gacy was reported to have been overweight and not athletic. He was close to his sisters and mother, but he had a difficult relationship with his father, who was an alcoholic and was physically abusive to his wife and children. That's just a little bit about his childhood. I mean, obviously, many serial killers have really sad, unhappy childhoods. Something maybe that carried over from his childhood was a fascination with clowns.
Clowns.
Rough.
That immediately raises red flags.
Yes.
Raises the hairs on the back of my neck.
If I were to ever meet someone who's like, I like clowns.
Yeah, no one says that. No one says they enjoy
clowns.
I've
never met someone who's like, I just really like clowns.
Yeah. I appreciate their craft.
Their craft of comedy.
I mean, like, I guess I do appreciate clowning in, like, a more traditional sense than, like, the commedia dell'arte, like, format. Mm. But, like, just, like, your typical, like, clown with the makeup and that. Like, no one.
It's freaky. Yeah. And I don't know if I ever, as a child, had any moment of joy with a clown. I just feel like anytime I saw a clown, I was like, get that guy away from me.
Yeah. Bye.
He's scary. Well, that would have been a really good first instinct because Gacy
does his good fight or flight right there.
John Wayne Gacy, when he wasn't murdering, liked to...
Was clowning.
He was clowning. He liked to be a clown.
Oh, no, that's terrible.
I'm serious. He became known as the killer clown because of his charitable services at fundraising events, parades, children's parties, at which he would dress as Pogo the Clown.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Or Patches. Pogo or Patches.
Yeah. I'm remembering all this is coming back to me because I did a high school project on John Wayne Gacy and I like forgot all of it like you do with the shit you learn in high school.
Right.
But I did want to just mention, because we haven't mentioned it yet on this episode, we're all very intoxicated right now and we may be laughing about murderers and we want to make it very clear that we do not think murder's funny.
She's literally laughing as she's saying this.
I am. We're just intoxicated and it's kind of a, I don't know, it's just a way to deal with it. Like, you laugh through the horror.
Yes.
Basically.
Sure. Yes.
So I just want to put that out there.
I mean, the fact that John Wayne...
Gacy.
Not just John Wayne. John Wayne was a different dude. Yeah.
John Wayne was a different man who walked with a permanent wedgie limp. But we're not talking about that John Wayne. We're talking about the murderer John Wayne.
Well, according to some sources, Gacy stated that acting as a clown allowed him to regress into childhood, which I do not understand because by all accounts, his childhood was wretched. He had a very unhappy home life with a father who beat him and just made him feel very bad all of the time. So I don't know, maybe just some kind of idealistic idea of what childhood was like. As an adult, he managed a few KFC restaurants that his father-in-law had purchased. You know, he was trying to make his life work out as a middle-class just kind of person. He had a wife who gave birth to two children in 1966, and then he had another daughter in 1967. So he was really working to earning his long sought approval of his father. And that sounds just real nice, you know? But however,
just doing his best.
It just seems that although that was the physical, like, outside appearance of what was going on, there's a seedier side of his life during this time, which involves wife swapping, prostitution, pornography, drug use. He was deeply involved in these activities. He cheated on his wife with local prostitutes. He opened a club in his basement where he allowed his employees to drink alcohol and play pool.
Cool.
That's real cool.
I mean, it does sound cool. He employed teenagers of both sexes at his restaurants.
Gender equality, but not cool.
Not cool. He socialized only with his young male employees. And he would give them alcohol before making sexual advances towards them, which if they rebuffed, he would claim were jokes or just like tests. I was just kidding. Ugh. It's believed that in 1967, Gacy committed his first known sexual assault on a teenage boy. 1967 is the first known reportable offense. Anyway, I don't like to give a lot of information or really spend too much time on the salacious details of how he may have lured and killed his victims, because fuck him. And yeah. I don't want to glorify that or give any of these details like, oh, and then he did this. It's like, he was a killer and he was a horrible person. Eventually, he gets arrested for being a murderer and an overall horrible human being, a detestable human being. And he's sentenced to death row. And so he becomes sentenced and he's on death row for 14 years. Isolated in his prison cell, Gacy began to paint. And so his subject matter varied, but many were clowns. And many of them were self-portraits of him depicted as the clown Pogo.
So interesting, though.
Stylistically, when you look at Pogo, I'm getting like a pop art. Like, it's very like heavy usage of primary colors, strong contour lines, like real solid block color.
Oh, Jesus. And I'm looking at images now and they are...
And it's horrifying.
It's horrifying, God. But like...
Pogo what? The clown is so scary. This painting is called Goodbye Pogo, and it's Pogo the clown. He's got his hand up and a sort of like, he's kind of waving. There's a little button on the front of his outfit that says, I'm Pogo the clown. And in the corner, J.W. Gacy is
in case y'all forgot.
Yeah, that was the artist. So Pogo the clown is a popular subject in his work. So here's where things get weird. John Wayne Gacy, he is sentenced to death and is killed by lethal injection in 1944. Upon his 1944 execution, Gacy had his lawyers put about 40 of his paintings up for sale, and these actually got a good deal of national attention. This is interesting, right? Because this has not really been seen before, this idea that serial killers like prison paintings would be put up for auction. Many of these paintings are actually bought by some people who decided to set many of them on fire in like a kind of bonfire in Naperville, Illinois. And in attendance were a few families of Gacy's victims. A few weeks before the event, Gacy had been killed by lethal injection. So that gave these people this kind of form of closure. Okay. So they bought the work, which is a little bit much. Like, they shouldn't have been paying for it, but whatever. Bought the work and decided to set it on fire. So these paintings, a lot of them were destroyed, but a lot of them were not destroyed. And so it's strange because Gacy's body of work becomes highly sought after. There's a whole instance of people that are just trying to get rich off of the artwork of John Wayne Gacy, which there's not like a lot. So you would never be like a multimillionaire, but you could make a pretty penny selling Gacy's work. We're not just considering Gacy. Many horrible human beings are put away in prison every day and there's not a lot to do. So many of them make art. This has led to the rise as something that's collectively known as murderabilia. So these are items that have spawned this active and diverse market, and people want to buy it because it's, you know, scandalous and
super
salacious.
Fascinating.
You're looking at the creative output of not just murderers, but like psychopaths
who
have systematically killed and like killed many. So the idea that you could buy a work of art made by Charles Manson or Dahmer or these killers that are, you know, no one just gets sent straight to death row, or I'm sorry, straight to a lethal injection. You're on death row for a long time. What do you do while you're in death row? A lot of these people are making art. And so there's a whole market now that seeks after this stuff. And this is much to the utter outrage of victims, victim rights advocates who are afraid that the profits of the sales are going back to the killers or just like incarcerated murderers themselves. And all of the cash from these sales is also going into the pockets of collectors. So people who are creative them like aren't making... They're not getting off death row, basically. Yeah. Like, they're still going to be killed by lethal injection eventually. So it's a strange time in ethical art market practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
How do we treat the work of known killers? Why is the work of John Wayne Gacy less appropriate to sell on the market than the work of someone like Caravaggio, who very famously murdered?
Yeah.
So
I think that kind of comes back to what we were talking about, like even just what I've realized.
Time is relative, baby.
It is. This episode, as we're recording it, it's like everything you said about Caravaggio did not make me even the least bit uncomfortable.
No.
But then we moved to Natalie's story, and I was a little more uncomfortable. Yep. And then we moved to John Wayne Gacy, and I am deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah, if you look like at the work, you're like, ah.
But it also is relativity. It's closer to me. Yeah. It is closer to me in time, and so I feel something different about it.
There's something to say for that, but it's also like the detail, and I don't know. There is something a little different about, like, Caravaggio was a painter and known to be a painter and then also had things on the side. Whereas, like, John Wayne Gacy... But like
Whereas
John Wayne
Gacy was a full-time murderer.
But like, would his paintings have ever even been anything if he was? Do you get what I mean? Like his paintings are only looked at because he was a serial killer. Exactly. And so that's why to me, just personally, like not speaking for the larger picture, but personally why I would feel more uncomfortable with something like that is to me, it's famous because the fact that he was a serial killer.
Right.
And,
which
and
is
that,
so
and,
like,
and clowns,
perverse.
And clowns, for whatever reason, are a perverse, gross kind of like creepy symbol, and so it's just compounded in a way that just makes me feel like I'm supposed to be scared of it, or like you're not supposed to be scared of a Caravaggio painting.
No.
And it's just that's what's a little different between those two. But like I do think that all of this is very much compounded by the proximity.
Totally. And I think we have so much more of like a conception of what a psychopath is now and what a serial killer is now, to where, not that there weren't psychopaths and serial killers during the 17th century, but like
we have no way of knowing.
We have no way of knowing, and I truly don't think it was at the degree that it is
because,
in more contemporary society, because we just have more extraneous factors that can...
Things that would create something like a serial killer.
I
or
also
like
think
a,
it's the idea that, so like, it's been proven, like, in terms of progression of history, we have gotten less violent over time, like, just in an objective way.
In a day-to-day survival context.
Yeah.
We have gotten less violent over time. So I think the thing, like, with more contemporary serial killers, they're outliers. They stand out because they're extremely violent and extremely, like, there's something just very, like, perverse about it. But, like, if you're looking in a historical context and you're looking back centuries, it's a different space where, like, being violent on a day-to-day basis is more normalized. Whereas, like, like, someone who's killing now is doing something very different than someone who is killing
hundreds of years ago. They have to be so systematic about it that it's, like, ugh. And it doesn't mean that they have different impulses. It, like, what you're saying is basically it could be the same impulse. It's just the way that people would be able to act on it then was more natural, and the way people do it now is so controlled, and like they have to be so just systematic that it's like unnerving,
because the idea is that we've progressed to a point where like that is not okay in any way, so it almost amplifies how bad it is,
right,
and the way people have to go about it to achieve it is
really fucked up and not okay, obviously. So it just I think it just amplifies our feelings, which is good. That's probably why we've gotten less violent over time. Because we have these reactions to these things. Like, it's good that we feel this visceral reaction to this, you know?
I mean, and there's no denying that Gacy was an outlier. Like, Gacy wasn't acting upon some kind of primordial desire to kill, like to defend oneself or whatever. I mean, when he was sentenced to death, according to published reports, he was a diagnosed psychopath and he did not express any remorse for his crimes. So his final statement to his lawyer was that killing him would not compensate for the loss of others and that the state was murdering him. His final spoken words were, "Kiss my ass."
Wow.
That's according to the Wikipedia article on John Wayne Gacy.
He was real fucked up. John Wayne Gacy. I keep saying John Wayne. I'm sorry, John. Sorry, John Wayne.
Not to be confused with the famous,
I don't think you killed
Hollywood
anyone.
Cowboy.
You did play Genghis Khan, though, and that was fucked up, John Wayne. That was fucked up.
Did you say Genghis?
Yeah, that's how it's said.
Genghis.
Genghis Khan, everyone.
Okay, that's like how Jenga the British say it. So, you know what? Kiss my arse.
Woo!
You just really want to be British, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I want to be James Fox's wife.
You all don't right. have to be British to be a British man's wife.
I'll be it. Whatever he wants. No, I'm kidding. Independence.
All right, everybody.
Make a life for yourself on your own, ladies.
It's okay, because as we've discussed, the theme of this episode is the art history babes are thirsty.
Ooh, child. Okay, so that was...
John Wayne Gacy.
That was John Wayne Gacy. That's what I have on Gacy.
So I guess it's my turn. I'm kind of mad because, like, I have to go last, and I'm, like, pretty drunk right now.
Corey is inebriated, but not in like a bad way, in a really good way, okay. In a cute way. She's really cute.
Thanks,
when she's drunk,
babe.
I love it.
I really appreciate that. Oh, we do need to take a break actually for ads.
All right,
for
check out
commercial
some of these
break.
Ads.
So here's someone that makes.
Do you like ads? Here you go, bitch. Hey, bitch, we're back. Bitch.
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 Oh, you're such a bitch. Okay, I have to talk about a murder now.
Tell us about your murder.
I'm going to do my best. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about Andrew Crispo.
Dude.
And the death mask murder of Igil Vesti.
Whoa. Whoa, who's that?
I don't even know what you just said. I don't.
That's
not
never
embarrassed.
Heard those and, words in her life.
And I've already said this, but I'm just going to say it again. My natural disposition is just to laugh, and I laugh when I'm uncomfortable. So if I laugh at really not okay places to laugh, yeah. Like I'm just covering my bases right now. Like
We know. Like, it's fine. No one here thinks that you think that murder is funny.
We should rename this episode, Murder's Not Funny.
In Don't parentheses, laugh. Art.
Do not laugh at this episode at all.
Murder is not funny.
And we'll still get 1,000 messages being like, fuck you guys, you think murder's funny.
We explicitly said...
My granddad was murdered in a mine.
We explicitly
in gold
said
country.
That murder was not funny.
You insensitive.
No one is laughing. How dare you?
How dare you? All right. Here we go.
Okay.
So, little background on Andrew Crispo, who is a hotshot New York art dealer in the 70s and 80s. Dealing art, had his gallery
Dude,
doing his thing.
The 80s and the art world was a fucking
crazy.
Weird time.
I
the
mean,
80s and the world world.
Yeah.
True, right. true. It was just such an opulent, luxurious period mm-hmm. of just excess and everything.
And it was just like, it was okay to
do
just...
Do hella blow.
And yeah, it was just cocaine and let's get rich all yeah. the time. The 80s were crazy.
Oh.
But I was born of them. So.
Cocaine was in for a long time.
Right.
But it was really big in the 80s.
Lots
like, it
of
was
coke.
Next level.
As we know it now. Before, it was just marketed differently.
Mm. Right. In but cough syrup.
Yeah. In, like, beverages.
But anyways, so Andrew Crispo, hotshot New York art dealer in the 70s and 80s. He was also just a very openly... kind of flamboyantly gay man, and he was known for being part of the like S&M hardcore party scene in New York City.
Nice.
Kind of, until it's really not.
Nice until it's very much not.
Oh, man.
I don't like where this is going.
Yeah.
Right.
So he's part of the scene, lots of drugs, lots of cocaine,
mm-hmm.
so much so that he was known to go through as much as 7 grams of coke in a single day.
Whoa! You know, so much coke.
Honestly,
holy shit.
I'm surprised that his brain didn't come out one nostril.
Yeah.
It probably did.
That
dude.
Is wild.
I know. And that was like, yeah, he was doing mad drugs, mad coke.
Wowee.
And so his gallery kind of, it became kind of an after hour spot for basically like drugs and kinky sex in the gay community.
Sure.
A lot of your handsome gay men would gather and have times, engage in activities there. It was a place. And
it was a place where things happened.
Things went down. And then on St. Patrick's Day of 1985.
Wow.
A group of young boys were hiking, which I feel like that's always how these
that's ominous
stories.
That is like a Stephen King.
I know. If I ever have a son or like just any child ever and they're like, I want to go hiking, I'm like, no, you're not 18 years of age and you're not allowed to go hiking.
You are still a boy.
You're still technically a child, and that's when horrible
right?
like shit
it's
happens
always,
to you apparently.
It is literally always a group of young boys
yeah.
stumble across some crazy shit.
No.
And it's just like that's just how this shit happens. Like, I go hiking all the time. I've never stumbled across anything mysterious or a dead body or any type of ancient
secrets.
That's because
you weren't with a bunch of teenage boys.
Exactly. Just like teenage boys.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you get a conglomeration of teenage boys.
You're going to find some secrets.
Conglomeration.
But I like conglomeration better.
In a weird way, I almost feel like it's like a life imitating art, because like you think back to like Stand By Me.
Dude, see?
It's like if you are in a group of young kind of
you're gonna come upon some shit.
Young pubescent boys, you're gonna fucking stumble on something.
And there will be horrendous bullies. And there will be picturesque scenes.
But there's going...
There's going to be scenes of woods with young boys.
And there might... There
finding
might,
shit.
There might be a dead body.
Oh, there's going to be.
All I'm saying.
So what happened?
And in this case, there was. Oh. There was a dead body. And this group of young boys were hiking, and they discovered the body of Igil Degvesti, who was...
Whoa.
What a name.
I know. He was a 26-year-old student... He was Norwegian, and he was a student at the Fashion Institute of Technology. So these boys were hiking, and they had kind of stumbled upon the property of one Bernard Legeros. And Bernard was an employee of our friend Andrew Crispo.
Okay.
The
fucking Crispo.
The hotshot New York art dealer. So Vesti was found. Basically, it was mostly remains. His body had been burned, and then it was like skeletal remains at this point, because it was months after the fact.
It's a dope metal band, by the way. Skeletal Remains. Look them up on Spotify.
Or wherever you get your music.
So it was a skeleton, aside from the head, which had been preserved by a leather bondage mask.
Oh, I don't know.
The rest of the body was skeletal, but the head had been preserved.
Oh, wow. Do you think he was wearing the mask when he died?
He was 100% wearing the mask when he died.
Well, I know. That was someone put it on after. I'm just, you know.
No. Just slipped it on.
I don't know. Corey,
come on. I don't know either, I guess.
All kinds of things could happen.
You're totally right. Like, who knows how people's minds work after they kill someone? I don't know. I have no idea. Vesti's head was really the only thing intact. It was covered in this black leather hood. Apparently, what had kind of transpired, what they found out, was that on September
10th.
is the new, there's, it's a 13-month September.
On the 1st of September.
On February 25th, 1985.
Everyone's going to be like, why is Jen laughing?
What a hilarious date.
February.
Oh, Jesus. Months are crazy.
Oh my God.
February.
I need to tell a story.
Tell the story.
I need to tell it.
Tell us your story.
Okay. On February 25th, 1985, basically.
Wait, September or February?
Do it again.
February.
Just say February 25th. On February 25th.
What's happening to us?
Oh my God. Let's just take another quick break. Another advertising break.
Here are some ads, bitch.
Okay, we're back. We've collected ourselves after that whole thing.
Oh, boy.
I hope you enjoyed a message from our sponsors that make the Art History Babes possible.
Yes.
So, on February 25th, 1985.
Yes.
Essentially, a night of drugs and some sadomasochism.
Whoa.
Turned really brutal and really fucked up.
Yeah.
And I'm going to just read you a little passage. A book has actually been written about this, like a whole book if you want every gory detail. It's called Bag of Toys, Sex, Scandal, and the Death Mask Murder by David France.
If you could see Natalie's face right now, Natalie is shaking her head harder than
Bag
I've ever seen.
Bag
of Toys.
Literally never wanted to read a book less in my whole life.
Bag of Toys.
Yeah.
No, thanks. Yeah.
But if this interests you and you want all the details, there's a whole book about it. But here's a little, just a little passage. As the sun came up, Crispo emerged from the basement, dragging a handcuffed vestie, naked except for a black leather hood, a jock strap, and a dog collar on the end of a leash. He's ready. He wants to die. Shoot him, Crispo said.
Oh, my God.
And Legeros did, pumping two bullets in the back of Vesti's head.
Whoa.
That is
like the ultimate fucking dark
shit. It's so fucking dark.
You go to a dungeon expecting, okay, you know what? I'm going to just give you guys a little peek into my personal life.
And what to expect from a dungeon.
Well, you know, I've been to a few, and you don't go in there expecting to get killed.
Of course not.
You murdered. Go in there thinking you're going to have some spankings, and maybe you might get, like, choked a little bit.
And you could, like, imagine that maybe you were, like, a medieval witch bitch queen.
Yeah.
And you will come out powerful and alive.
Yeah, it's hot.
Not shot.
It's not supposed to be fear-filled at all.
No.
That's
the thing about S&M in general. It's, you know, it's 100% a consensual, like,
consent. There has to be consent.
And we're like,
even if
and we're like
fearful, like it's consensual fear. You know,
you have control.
That's control. That is the ideal. Like, you go into it knowing that you're working within a constraint of, like, systems that are operating off of this idea of consent.
Yeah, and
consent.
Like, yeah, controlled fear. So, like, a fear that you know is only going to go so far.
Controlled fear. Great.
You're not going to get hurt.
It's
within your control.
But obviously these motherfuckers
were
evil. Basically, so it was Crispo, this hotshot art dealer, and then Legeros, who worked for Crispo, was the one who actually shot this man in the head. What kind of came to be throughout the investigation was that it was very intentional. It was very kind of going back to our talk on serial killers. It was thought out and planned. Two of them, Crispo and Legeros, went out to Manhattan's Hellfire Club and picked up Vesty legitimately because they wanted to kill someone. Like, it was always the intention. It had been reported that Ligeros was very troubled as a child and had a bit of an obsession with death. But then also that Crispo had this kind of like power over Ligeros.
Totally.
Like, Ligeros was kind of his like henchman, like, you know, that.
Like, he took care of him. He like gave him stability, but he also totally took advantage of him in terms of having him do a lot of shit for him.
And then what gets really kind of interesting moving into the trial. So they found, as I said, they found Vesty on Ligeros' properties. They pretty quickly started putting the pieces together, started investigating the S&M scene in New York and all of this. And then Ligeros admitted to the murder. He admitted straight up to the murder. But somehow Crispo never even testified in this entire thing. He was never even brought to trial. And apparently Ligeros' testimony against Crispo was unusable purely because Crispo pled the fifth. Like, he pled the fifth, and therefore Ligeros' testimony against him didn't hold up in court in any way. So Crispo was, like, never brought to trial in any way, despite very much involved, you know, in the murder. Even though he didn't pull the trigger, he was involved in this murder.
Yeah.
Obviously, this was a very high-profile case, not only because it was, like, it kind of shook the art world, but it shook the gay community, it shook the S&M community, it shook all these different communities that suddenly felt fearful and suddenly, you know, just were, like, worried, didn't feel safe, and it got a lot of coverage by the media. Ligeros was found guilty, and he is serving a 25-to-life sentence at Rikers. Crispo, on the other hand, never faced a single charge in regards to this murder. However, he ended up in jail over a smattering of other charges. Tax evasion landed him 5 years. And then in 1999, he planned to abduct a lawyer's daughter over some money shit.
And that's what, like, 7 grams of coke a day
is going to do to you.
Oh, my God. Yikes. Brain. I, like, quickly forgot about that number.
I think just I got that number me. Right.
Yeah, yeah, it was like 6 or 7.
It was
grams.
A lot.
It was
oh
a lot.
My
God.
Yeah.
Too much.
He planned to abduct this lawyer's daughter over something involving money, and he was caught and sentenced to a max of 20 years. So he
is a bitch.
Bitch.
Ginny calling everyone bitch is going to be like my 2019 aesthetic. Yeah, so I don't know. It's just like super dark and dramatic and like gross and ugly and sad. Like,
yeah, that's a very good like compilation of words.
Yeah, there's no happy ceramic t-shirt ending to that
story. No, there really isn't. I mean, it's, I guess it's good they're both in jail, like that's good, you know, but like it's just fucked up. And I think it affects, I don't know, it just affects so much. It affects, I'm sure, how people think about artists, how people think about the gay community, how people think about the S&M community. It just like colors these things with this really horrific thing, and it sucks. It just sucks.
It does. It does. In a weird way, too, like, even though it's kind of unrelated, but like, I got into a sort of deep dive about like the whole Party Monster documentary and murder, and that, like,
I love that movie.
1990s New York gay like club party scene.
Yeah, like the club kids.
Exactly. And how that got like super tainted with visions of like murder and gore. And well, how isn't that behind tied into,
didn't that happen? Isn't that a real life story with like a James St. James?
So James St. James didn't do the murder. This dude named Michael something did.
Okay.
Whose name I forget.
He was just implicated.
Other podcasts do an episode on that, like My Favorite Murder.
Watch Party Monster with Macaulay Culkin and Seth Green.
Macaulay Culkin.
Oh my God, he's so good.
Unsung actor gem.
Yeah, you know, when you're dealing with all these communities that are already somewhat marginalized, it like fucking sucks because like these communities that already get like a bad rap or like people don't understand or people aren't willing to understand, immediately they're going to jump to, oh, this really fucked up thing happened. Even though really fucked up things happen in every community, you know?
Of course.
But this one happened to happen in a community that was like dramatic and high profile and like, you know, people already wanted to villainize these communities.
Right. Yes. And unfortunately, it happened like in such a way where it became easy to vilify.
Exactly. And they, and that's what that's 100% what happened. Like Andrew Crispo and fucking what's his name,
Legeros,
Bernard Legeros are pieces of shit, and they like did something really fucked up, and they were doing way too much coke, and like
it's just too much.
Like there's not like a good amount of coke to do, but like don't do that much. You know,
but that is definitely doing it wrong.
If you're gonna do a lot of coke, don't do that much.
We have discussed a whole array of murders that have touched the art world in some capacity. There's more, you know.
Always more.
We don't want this to be a four-part episode, so...
Oh, God.
So we'll sign off.
We'll do a quick listener mail.
Oh, yes. We're not signing off yet.
Okay, well, just... This one comes to us from Claire from Sydney.
Australia.
Cool.
I am writing from the Blue Mountains, Australia, about an hour and a half drive from Sydney. I discovered you guys when searching for podcasts about color theory, all of which were shit except for yours.
Oh,
I love
thanks,
that.
Girl.
That's so nice. I am a casual art appreciator, but I absolutely love you guys and have been devouring your podcast for the past 2 weeks. I heard Corey mention Hannah Gatsby's Nanette on one of the podcasts. If you guys are fans of Hannah's, she also has done two short documentary series for Australian TV. Hannah Gatsby's Naked Nudes, about female representation in art through the male gaze. There's a crossover with some of the themes discussed in Nanette. She just doesn't yell quite as much. And then Hannah Gatsby's Oz, which is about the history of Australian art. There are a lot of guys in hats on horses.
Sure. But that sounds absolutely right to me.
But if you have an interest in Australian art, I would recommend it. Even if you don't, I would still recommend it because Hannah is a delight. I haven't had a lot of luck finding it on YouTube, but it's available on iTunes down here, so it may also be in the States. Keep up the good work. You guys are awesome. Love and baby koala kisses.
Claire. What? That may be the sweetest sign-off we've ever had.
No, I love it. Also, all of that is great, and I want to check it all out immediately.
Yeah, we love Hannah Gatsby.
Hannah's amazing, and yeah, we love you. I'm so glad you liked color theory. And
thank you for writing. When I think about the color theory episodes, I'm almost like, oh god, I get a little bit worried. Like,
do I
really want to go back and listen to that episode?
That was a long time ago.
But thank you so much for writing in and like the tips and just, yeah, the cutest sign off of all of time.
So much.
So good. Word. We love it. So it's been we took you on an adventure tonight.
I hope you had fun.
I hope you buckled up when I told you to.
Yes. We crossed many a geographical plane as well as temporal planes.
An astrological plane.
All throughout blood and death was ever present.
I love you right now.
That is all I can and should say for the evening.
Halloween.
How do you follow that up?
Make sure to listen to all of our other Halloween episodes. We have other good ones too.
We do.
We have Memento Mori. We have Haunted Paintings. Oh, yeah. So check out all of our other Halloween content. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm
sleepy.
Thank you.
It's been a great adventure.
It's been so fun.
Good night, y'all.
Have the best Halloween spooky times.
John Wayne liked clowns. This is new.
Oh, yes. Oh, he loved clowns.
John Wayne Gacy. You really got to throw that Gacy in
there. John Wayne and John Wayne Gacy are two different people.
I'm sorry, John Wayne, to your memory, to your family, to your legacy.
Hello, all. Corey again. If you want to become a patron and help make the continued production of Art History Babes content possible, as well as become part of the Art History Babes special community, head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes. There's also a link in the show notes for you. Also, we're doing a giveaway in honor of the Patreon relaunch. You can be entered to win a goodie box, including a copy of our book, The Honest Art Dictionary, Art History Babe stickers, chocolate, a candle, these cute little art cards that Natalie has. Check our Patreon or our Instagram for pictures, but they're really fun. To be entered to win, become a patron. Every dollar pledged is an entry. So, for example, if you become a patron at the $3 level, $3 equals 3 entries. If you're already a patron, you just have to up your donation amount for entries. So, if you are currently at the $1 amount, up it to $5, and you get 4 entries in the giveaway. This giveaway will run all of October, and we will choose the winner on November 1st. Thanks again for listening and for your continued support. We're really excited to share all the new things we have in store with you. Bye!
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.